I want to start by addressing the previous debate and the theme of this conference, 20 years on from the declaration of the Loyalist ceasefire. In doing so, I think it's important to recognise that October 94 was not the beginning of Loyalist involvement in the process, but the culmination of it. Loyalists had showed vision prior to 94 and had shown a willingness to move first. In 91, the ceasefire, much overlooked but is pertinent, and that it demonstrated the desire for an exploration of a possible end to conflict at the head of that conflict. Unfortunately, IRA bombs and a lack of political leadership consigned the opportunity to history, but the Loyalist vision remained, and a determination to assist in creating a space for dialogue remained also. The words of the ceasefire declaration were in themselves visionary, words offered with an inherent magnanimity that set the context for a process that so often failed to honour by the generosity epitomised in those words. 20 years on, I want to pay tribute to that vision, that commitment, that determination to hold firm in the pursuit of political stability and ultimately of peace. I want to recognise the value of the Loyalist leadership against untold pressure and under lethal threat. I want to recognise the resolve of those who held back a tide of discontent and remained focused on the ultimate goal. For without that Loyalist leadership, make no mistake about it, we would not have a peace process, we would have no institutions, and the future of this country would be a lot less bright. And I think we must recognise today the self-sufficiency that has governed Loyalism and has charted such an uncertain path. Unrecognised for its efforts, external analysis has singularly failed to appreciate the depth of Loyalist achievement. Indeed, such lack of objective analysis has left a vacuum used by those whose interest is served when Loyalism is written out of history. And chief among the obstacles faced by Loyalism in this tumultuous process has been the belligerence of republicanism and the continued shadow of republican violent threat. The United Ireland is a fantasy, a Gaelic myth, nowhere to be found on real-life agenda of these islands' future relationships. Sinn Féin's abject failure to achieve their singular objective has given birth to an ugly campaign of cultural warfare. Unable to remove the British presence, their sights are now set on British values. Unwittingly aided by those who refuse to learn from history, Sinn Féin today wave the ballot box with one hand and whisper the threat of dissidence behind the other. Republican efforts at masking our constitutional failure to go from the petty to the downright dangerous. The childish refusal to call by name the state they in part govern is playground politics of the most puerile form. The manipulation of the parades issue is irresponsible and malicious, but we will face those challenges down and resist them at every step. The past 20 years has seen Loyalism develop a programme of unarmed resistance. Today we remain committed to that end. In North Belfast and elsewhere, we remain committed to the defence of British rights and to robustly opposing those who deny those rights. The Republican strategy is short-sighted and it will not work. Indeed, it only serves to galvanise the unionist community. This party remains committed to our role within the combined unionist leadership on the North Belfast impasse on parades in general and other matters of mutual unionist interest. We believe the North Belfast situation is illustrative of this country's major problems and integral to overcoming them. The suppression of its rights is unsustainable. Unresolved, it will continue to impact every level of political life. We resolve to making sure the plight of the Loyalist bonds and brethren remain at the very core of the political process. Hundreds of our young people have faced the judicial system, the result of frustration and failure in leadership that should be a thing of the past. The future of political action and associated protests should come from the combined unionist leadership, doing just that, standing up and showing leadership. Whatever form of talks process emerges over the next few days, that leadership must reveal itself at the table and ensure that any potential agreement gives due emphasis to the Trudeau deadlock and to the right to civil and religious freedom. And let me say on that, the North Belfast impasse remains central, a central issue by virtue of the commitment of those stalwarts who have refused to break faith for nigh on 15 months. that that process was held firm despite unprecedented pressure is testament to the strength of their resolve. We have stood with them and we will remain with them until a satisfactory conclusion is reached. Negotiations on Tweddale, parades and the wider process must also recognise the role of loyalism over the past 20 years. The architects of the process would do well to be cognisant of our contribution and our vision. It would be a grave mistake to neglect the voice and concerns of loyalism, whatever the possible outcome. Those talks, however opaque they may appear, at this point have many very serious decisions to reach. The future of Northern Ireland's devolved framework, and by implication our changing role within an evolving union, is at stake. As someone proud to have been involved in securing devolution for this region, I can say very clearly, this is not what we had in mind. The convoluted framework that forced Monterey Coalition was an emergency measure, agreed to achieve political stability, but always expected to evolve in the interests of good governance. In negotiations, we had pursued our decades-held position of sharing responsibility, a committee form of government which avoided the constant deadlock of competing forces tearing government asunder. We sought a system that shared the responsibility of good governance toward a common vision. We ended up with a system where power is carved up and bad governance too often the result of competing and conflicting visions. It is time to move on. Let me make it clear, this is not a lurch to the past or nostalgic yearning for the return of a one-party state. That is not what we are about. This party is founded on inclusion, socially and politically. We fully accept the unique difficulties of our region and recognise they need to be accommodated in a structure of government. But the current system is neither fit for purpose nor delivering for the people of this country. Today I submit our support for the creation of an official opposition. A voluntary coalition, by way of weighted majority, can satisfy the historic concerns of nationalism, but allow a government based on shared vision rather than electoral default. It would encourage a programme of government free from the terminal ambivalence that has dogged progress and hampered delivery. A government audited by scrutiny of an official opposition, divested with facilities and resources to hold government to account and to expose those not fit for the task or not committed to the challenge. We have serious questions about Sinn Féin's commitment to the success of this state. The Northern Ireland government must govern in the interests of Northern Ireland. There can be no equivocation on that central point. If not, they should be exposed as such, and the electorate should have a clear ability to remove from government those it had placed in that government. The talks process will firstly have to deal with the failure to agree a budget and to plan and reconcile fiscal shortages, penalties and reductions. Let me say firstly that this party is opposed ideologically and principally to welfare cuts. Our record is clear to see. This conference, the highest decision-making body in our constitution, passed a motion against the current welfare reform 2 years ago. We reinforced that view in debate last year also. But what we oppose specifically is narrow party political posturing that puts at risk not only this society's most vulnerable, but also the whole fabric of government. What we oppose specifically is playing the politics of another jurisdiction and the holding at ransom of our political system for the veneer of consistency elsewhere. Our executive parties, as dysfunctional and myopic as they are, have been tasked with the privilege of governing this country. They have a democratic and moral imperative to get on with that task. What we need to see quickly are those whose job it is to govern, to do that job and govern. And what they need to do is prove that this megaphone diplomacy on welfare reform and its impact on budget is not empty bluster. They need to get on with the task of government with a focus on protecting the vulnerable. They need to travel to the margins of society and ensure, by ways of efficiencies and imagination, that the safety net so integral to our British identity does not give way. They need to maintain a focus on those who daily struggle as far removed from the abstract squabbles of Stormont. I personally have lobbied government to set in place a system of case studies tracking at the coalface the effect of welfare reform on society's most vulnerable. What we need is a consistent and thorough examination of its real impact on people. We believe that a government-backed programme, piloted over an 18-month period, could give us the clearest picture yet where we are failing those in the margins of society. What I mean by that is that we need to actually be taking different types of families and people who are on benefits or maybe even already in poverty and show in 18 months how worse they are off. So whether it's, you know, people living in Divis or whether it's people living in the towers of Craigie, it doesn't matter, or elsewhere. You know, we need to actually make sure that we hold these people to account. Then what we need to do with such information, we could tailor policy, helping those who need it most by actions rather than simply by words. As yet, the door remains closed and the relevant departments refuse to consider such a plan, but this party will not relent on forcing these issues onto the agenda. We need a future government of clear priorities, priorities which serve the people, not the government. The education system is clearly broken. The system has failed. The system needs uprooted and changed. As we all know, the levels of educational achievement and disadvantage there is are an outrage. And it's been this party who's led this since the 1990s. No one else. And we've heard some of the discussions that come from the panel, and we know why. Because Big House Unionism is not interested in doing what's needed. In traditional loyalist areas, our young people fall even lower than a pitiful average. But none of this is new. This party has been screaming it for over 20 years. But we're in the interest from government, from those who say they care, those whose job it is to remedy. I can't see it. We've waited for a long time for people to deal with education. And what we had was deals over the maze to stop education being resolved. We still ask children with the reading age of 9 to sit a transfer test drafted for 11-year-olds and then wonder why the results are less than average. We really need to sort this out. You know, we need to find ways of how we actually do this. A transfer test that recognises capacity in its narrowest sense yet determines the course of our young people's future long before they are able to cope with a reckoning of such magnitude. And they wonder what is wrong. We yearn to grasp the issue. We have the policies that could bring real change. From incentivising our brightest teachers to teach at our worst performing schools, fast-tracking the recognition of accidents for those who have turned the curve of underperformance, a system of education in our most disadvantaged areas which is joined up and wrapped around, where parents are encouraged, health is considered, and schooling doesn't begin at 9 a.m. and finish at 3 p.m. We have policies to meet heads on the challenging future of generations. And the reality is, it wasn't that long ago that I sat on the inspection team for the Department of Education, and I didn't do anything in Belfast. I asked not to work in Belfast, and I worked outside Belfast. And I can tell you, I seen principals and teachers who were turning schools around. They did it day and daily, and still with all, we can't actually make sure that we have these people and send them in. You know, one of the first things that I was taught or told when I arrived at the inspector team, they told me there was no such thing as bad teachers. There was only bad teaching. Now, for me, I don't know how you differentiate between those two. But that was the argument. If we're going to continually use that argument, then we're never going to win. I urge today again that the parties of government stop listening to themselves and listen to us. At the very least, listen to the plea of future generations. We need change. And it needs to start with education, but not stop there. Employability, linked directly to education and training, must be a key component to any future growth strategy. We need joined up thinking in government, working hand in hand with local businesses. Our manufacturing base is under threat. Recent job losses at JTI and Bombardier are the gravest of examples. We can't just sit back and wait for more. We need to go ahead of the curve on this. Manufacturing is changing, and so must the focus of our manufacturing industry, aided and abetted by government. Instead of lusting after the white elephant of lower corporation tax, government would be best served helping those businesses already here, instead of dubious and costly gamble on those who may never come. And that's a very important point for us because, you know, the five parties in government think that corporation tax is going to solve our problems. Corporation tax is just being lazy. It's about asking for more incentives. Surely we need to get out of this notion that we need incentives for Westminster to do everything. Maybe we should be changing things where we're actually making money. And who does it benefit? A lot of these people, you know, talk about people who are on benefits and the poor. And William Ennis, our treasurer, reminded me a couple of days ago that, you know, in terms of people who actually, in many ways, work the system, I think it, in terms of benefit fraud, it's 1 billion. In terms of tax, not paying taxes avoidance, it's 70 billion. And the problem with that is that, you know, if this is what we do, and we say, OK, we're going to stop the rich from paying, and then we're allowing others who are poor, we're going to take more off them. It's not how this should work. But, you know, we need to help small local firms fill in their gaps in expertise and knowledge, feed them with the information and assistance required to grow. We need to identify areas in disadvantaged communities and invigorate them with enterprise zones tailored to bring employment to suit all levels. We need a forward-thinking government able to overcome big challenges and big ideas and big decisions. If they're unprepared for that role, we'll certainly step up in their place. And if corporation tax alone of it is all they're offering us, God help us. If we look at one of the most successful countries in the world, Germany, you'll be paying 35%. And they're asking us to lower it. They come into line with the Republic of Ireland at 12.5%. Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago the British government had to actually bail them out by giving them billions of pounds. So I don't understand why they think a corporation tax lowered works. But anyway, my colleague in this party, but also this year in Belfast City Council, Councillor Julian Corr, spoke this morning about this party as a forward-thinking, forward-moving vehicle. I want to echo that sentiment. I also want to thank you, the party members and activists who are the engine of this vehicle. Over the past year, this party has had the privilege to count on some of the hardest working, most genuine and passionate political activists in this country. I'm heartened to see so many of you in this room this afternoon. You're to be commended for your efforts. I think our recent electoral advancement is proof of that, and you deserve it. This party is an exciting place to be today. We have broken through a glass ceiling with our performance in the elections past, written off, demonised, not counted. We forced our way onto the stage. We doubled our seats and more than tripled our vote, a stunning result by anyone's definition. And we came tantalisingly close in many more key areas. Now the glass ceiling is broken, we cannot rest on our laurels, and we must keep striving forward, keep securing change for our communities and for society as a whole. For this is not about elections. Elected office is for us a means to an end. We exist to help and inspire our communities, but can do so better with the level of electoral influence. The self-fulfilling dynamism that gained traction in the last election is set well on its course. We can bring more change, land more office, land deeper change, land further office. This cycle is clear. The path is clear. You, the drivers of change, are clear of focus and intent. Together, let's complete the journey. Thank you, Congress.